Blog Talk Radio.
Intelligence. What is intelligence? A sign of a high intelligence is, according to psychiatrists and scientists, is a person having a pleasant attitude towards learning, relationships, social life, criticism, feedback, and ultimately a hard-working person. Person who has empathy, a person who looks at other people and understands what's going on there, then a person with a high intelligence become a serial killer. A person who manipulates and sees things in a different way. A person who ultimately takes all of those types of characteristics and warps them in a different way. How does a sociopath or a psychopath get defined with a high intelligence? And why do people with high IQs become sociopaths or psychopaths? That's what we're going to be looking at tonight as Murder and Mayhem. Sunday Night Murder and Mayhem presents the genius of evil. As we look at five of the worst serial killers of all time. I want to thank a team of voices for sponsoring what we have going on here. The AP Taylor Foundation for helping us have a team of voices, blog talk radio podcasts, and everybody else who writes for us and who does things just in a tremendous fashion for this station and for this show. Without further ado, hello, hello. How are you doing?
Just fine. Unmuted.
Unmuted. How you doing, Hatter?
All right.
Hey, we're going to be, this is going to be one of the most interesting subjects that I think I've grabbed a hold of, because in this episode, we're going to look at some extremely intelligent people who turned around and became some of the most vile serial killers in the history of the United States. And we'll be talking about them. I think I'm going to start with Rodney Alcala, who was known as the dating game murderer, because this guy actually was on the dating game and won.
Yeah, that's when I wrote. That's when I wrote about.
That's great. That's great. So why don't we? You have your poem ready. We'll go ahead and have you read about it. Read it, and then we'll go ahead and start straight up with Rodney Alcala. And I'm going to then probably put Rodney Alcala. I want to just say that he did take a IQ test and scored an IQ of 135 for the Army psychiatrist, but then was determined that after several other people looked at him, they estimate that his true IQ was closer to 170, which absolutely, when you take a look at it, I think Einstein was at 150. So he had
160.
He was actually considered more intelligent than Einstein. But the brutality of who he was just immense. So why don't you go ahead and I see you put your poem up there. Go ahead and read it off.
Well, did you want to describe a little more of it, or you want me to read it first?
I think you read it first, and then we'll go ahead and dig into him a little bit, because one of the most fascinating things about him was his trial. And for that effect, and we'll take a look at everything that he ended up doing.
Okay. Yeah, that was bizarre, his appearance on the dating game and winning. I sort of wrote to the fact of how lucky that girl was not being one of the victims. I'm assuming she wasn't one of the
victims. No, she wasn't. She went ahead and declined the date, and I'll bring more into that after you read.
Okay. I just titled it his name, Rodney James Alcala, dead at 71. It was like this. Little did we know it was all from the show, and surprised of his high IQ. Listen to this tale and listen very well. This could have happened to you. He became a winner. He won one night. He dated a pretty but hid in plain sight. He met a girl on a dating show the producers had set where they were to go. The chat was uneven. The stories were not. Uncomfortable pauses in the things he bought. Suggesting to leave and to take her home, he knew then he'd have her alone. He planned the unthinkable to end his date. He thought of dismembering and the mess it makes. I need to stop and get some things. It's on our way, he's apologizing. Listen to some music. I'll be right back. He returns with some bleach and a full paper sack. His date was lucky, and it was not too late. He stopped on her street near her open gate. He planned to choke her as he helped her to her feet. When some lights started approaching from down the street, he held her hand like a gentle man and walked her to her door. With the headlight still near, it was not and he was not in the clear to get away, with his chances were less than very poor. She smiled at him, not knowing his plans. She said thank you and turned, releasing his hand. Rod spun to curse the lights that ruined his plans that murderous night. This girl had angels that kept her safe when Rodney James Akala, she had been on a date. Killing for fun is just killed just the same. Never date blindly from the dating game.
No,
I guess she didn't. So that's good.
I love this. I absolutely love this. This was a cool rendition of it. And it would have been awesome if, you know, ultimately this ended up like that. That was great, though. She actually was very uncomfortable backstage with him and declined to go on the date with him because of the uncomfortability. They said that actually one of the guys that was his opponent on the dating game actually said that he was a very, very odd individual, very strange fellow. That's the way he described him. Now, like I said before, the thing about it, he was tried 3 times for one of the murders, and it was a 12-year-old. And the first trial, he got off because of the fact that they weren't supposed to mention his background in his criminal background, being a sexual predator and such, because what that did is it influenced the jury to give him a guilty verdict. And so the judge threw out that particular trial. Then he went to the second trial, and once again he was found guilty and sentenced to death. But there were some situations behind that he went ahead and got that conviction thrown out as well. And the higher court went ahead and did the same thing. So he ended up having a third trial in 2010, and they finally found DNA evidence, because they weren't able to use the DNA evidence at the time because it was all in the 1970s when DNA wasn't at its full force. They ended up convicting, tying him into 4 other murders, and he ended up getting tried. The judge said the prosecution can tie all 5 murders together within his trial. And due to that, he was once again found guilty, this time of all 5 murders, and sentenced to death. At the time, he was also being considered for charges of murder in New York State. They were going to drop it, but a grand jury went forward and charged him with those 2 murders. He went back there and went ahead and he originally pled not guilty to the murders, but then because he wanted to come back to California to fight his death penalty conviction, he went ahead and just entered guilty pleas, since New York State does not have guilty pleas, does not have a death sentence. So ultimately that was his idea. I mean, at his 2010 trial, he actually did a bunch of different things. He went ahead and played a clip from the dating game, saying that he was wearing the quote unquote 12-year-old's earrings at the time. He didn't even fight the charges of the other 4 murders. He just during the entire trial fought the charges of the 12-year-old's murder, which was strange at the time. But you actually wonder what drove him to do everything that he did. Now, he was found guilty of murder in California and New York State. And after that, they ended up tying him to a bunch of other cases around the country. So one thing is that he was found, let me see, where was it? There was a hitchhiker in Wyoming that they went ahead and figured out she was dumped in Wyoming, but she was not identified through DNA until 2015, and Alcala actually had one of her photographs. You know, he had thousands of photographs of young women, young girls, and young boys that they think he were more of his victims. There were several that came out after he passed away that actually were tied into his pictures. There was one person from San Francisco. There was this girl up in Wyoming. There's other cases that they are still searching through those photographs for what he did. Now, ultimately, how do you take a look at a person like this, especially somebody with such high intelligence, and why do they turn around and perform such atrocities, such evil acts? And you got to ask yourself that. But ultimately, when you take a look at lifestyles and you take a look at these people, they're getting a thrill out of this. This was a game to him. He created this persona and this alias of a person by the name of John Berger that he took around the country, and even in the dating game, they said he was a photographer. He was a successful photographer. That was how they described him. They didn't have an idea what type of photographs that he went ahead and was doing. So when he was introduced, he said he was a successful photographer. Between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling. So it was absolutely insane and insanity.
Who dressed the girls up sometimes and took pictures of the last moments? And you can see the fear in their face.
I don't think that was the same person, but I can tell you that after he killed several of them, he put them in specific poses as if it was like a piece of art to him. It was like he did take pictures of them afterwards. But it's very interesting to see someone with such a high intelligence go off and do something like this. You wonder, ultimately, he was never really interviewed on what he did or anything like that. But I can tell you he was, he had a his father abandoned the family. And that may have something to do with what was going on with him. I don't know. But he joined the Army in 61, where his commanding officer said he was very manipulative, vindictive, and insubordinate. And while he was in the Army, he actually was disciplined for assaulting young women. So this was something that happened. He had a nervous breakdown and went AWOL from Fort Bragg and went all the way to his mother's house in California. He was discharged because of medical reasons. When you take a look at his psychiatric history, there were so many diagnoses that he was given. The first one was antisocial personality disorder, which we will see in another one of our people, in another one of these serial killers here. Narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, malignant narcissism with psychopathy, sexual sadism, and it was crazy. I mean, you take a look. All of these doctors looking at a person like this, given everything like that, you will just wonder what you know. Everybody just tries to describe these people through psychiatric reasons, like there's a problem with them. But a person with such a high intelligence like that never sees the problem in themselves. I think a perfect example was when he won the dating game and he was rejected by that girl. He didn't see a problem in himself. He saw the problem in that girl.
Yeah, I think he probably avoided the he fought the murder of the girl, the Tina, the child. If all the other ones were adult, because you're treated. If he was considering possibly spending decades or the rest of his life in prison to kill a kid, you're a child killer. You wouldn't last long. So he might have been thinking about.
Yeah, he was actually fighting it to not get the death penalty. He was trying to fight the death penalty is what he was doing. And ultimately it worked because he died of natural causes in prison.
Well, California, you could be sent to, on the death penalty, sit on death row for 30 years.
And that's almost what he did. He sat up there for 20-some years. So. Yeah,
it's not so much the death penalty as it is the other inmates. You're a child killer. You're not going to last long.
Oh, and you're right. You're right on that. But like I said, it ultimately, when you take a look at a sociopath in this type of situation, you look at a person who doesn't put blame on themselves. They look at everything else that could be blamed. This was the victim's fault. This is what a sociopath does. He doesn't blame stuff on themselves, but turns around and makes excuses. There was a doctor at the dating game that said this. One wonders what this did to his mind. This was a psychiatrist by the name of Pat Brown, a criminal profiler. Pat Brown said, one wonders what this did to his mind when he was turned down by that woman on the dating game. That is something he would not take well. Something is wrong with the girl. You know, they would say things like, she played me. She played hard to get. She wanted to live. You know, and ultimately he went off on a murder spree after she rejected him on that show. So, like I said, that could ultimately be. when you look at sociopaths, that's what happens. And hey, sweet, how you doing?
Did I miss the show? Did it start at 7?
No, it just started like 25 minutes ago.
Oh, you start on a half hour, don't you? Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. It's perfectly okay.
Oh,
we just got done talking about Rodney Alcala, who was the dating game killer.
You can't? Okay. All right.
Why?
That was
what poem did you write? That was your
I'm not done. I have like two stanzas to finish. I spent so much time on this guy.
You go ahead and finish on that. We're still talking about him a little bit.
Oh my God! What a creep.
I know. I was talking about the criminal profiler that was talking about when he was rejected from by that woman on the dating game. He went on an absolute crime spree right after that, because sociopaths don't recognize that they have a problem. They look at their victims and say, or they look at someone who could have been their victim and say, you know, it's their fault that they died, or it's their fault that I didn't kill them, you know, and they justify that in their mind in that particular way. The only real trigger, like I said, when he was a kid, is that his father abandoned the family, took him down to Mexico, and then abandoned the family. Mom brought him back up to Los Angeles. Otherwise, he was smart. He was intelligent. He was his mindset in it, what he could learn was crazy. He was on the yearbook planning committee. He was in the track and cross country teams. He graduated and spent most of his time in private schools. And then he joined the Army, but that's when everything started turning on him. When they noticed there was stuff going wrong with him when he was assaulting young women in the Army. A lot of that's where he was diagnosed with the antisocial personality disorder. Like I said,
JC, back then, if you got in trouble with the law, they gave you a choice: go before the judge or go join the Army. So he might have been in trouble, because he doesn't sound like a guy that would join the Army.
Yeah, he was a paratrooper, actually. He trained as a paratrooper, but they put him as a clerk. So I can tell you, when you join the military, since I've joined the military, when you train for something and you get put in a different job than what you get trained for, there's a little resentment there. There is resentment there, okay, and I can understand, but when you take a look at the position he was put in with the particular intelligence that he has, and having a intelligence that you can manipulate the situation you're in, being a clerk, I have a feeling that he was more of a supply clerk or something to that effect, because that's normally what you say as being a clerk, that you're in supply. He could have used his position to get what he wants. And like I said, that could have fed into his sociopathic tendencies as well. When you're put into a type of position like that, and that's how I look at him as well. One of the crazy things about him is he actually went to New York. He went to New York University after he graduated from UCLA School of Fine Arts. He moved up to New York and actually studied under Roman Polanski up in New York, which is crazy. You know, you'll see in some of these serial killers, especially the ones that have the intelligence, they have tied themselves into people that are looked up in society, who have a little bit more. There was an absolute crazy thing, because he assaulted a girl in California. As soon as that happened, he moved to New York to get away from it. And he used the name John Berger. He knew what he was doing. You know, a lot of the times these people say they don't know what they're doing. They can't figure it out. They have this craving inside of them. He knew what he was doing. He really did. And as they slowly tied in everything to him, he served prison time before he was finally captured for the murders, even though he murdered and then was then served prison time after he was identified as who he was. But he kept on getting paroled. He got paroled because he could use what he has, his manipulation, his sociopathic tendencies with that high intelligence to go ahead and control the situation. He pretty much said that he there's a lot of them that played with the doctors that used what they knew, how they knew, just to manipulate the doctors. And I think that's a big thing that goes with that. I know I need to talk about the other people as well that I brought up. How close are you, sweet?
I'm done.
What's that? Okay.
I'm done. I'm ready.
Let's kick it out there then, and we'll finish up our discussion on Rodney Alcala with your poem.
All righty, then. Oh, no. Hold on. How bad is this? Hold on. I got to do something real quick. I apologize, but it's coming. It's worth it.
Nope. No problem. No problem. I know I'm going to end on I'm going to end tonight on Ted Bundy. I'm going to go.
Oh, of course you are. Who wouldn't?
Yeah, I think what we're going to do next is right after Rodney Alcala, I'm going to start talking about Jeffrey Dahmer. So we're going to have these are all just wild, wild people. And I don't know how many of you listened to some of those interviews that I posted on there.
I just, yeah. All right, it
I listened
is
to
up
the
now.
Which one did you listen to?
The Rodney.
Dating game one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, sweet. Go ahead.
All right, this is 1972. January 24th, 1972. He found me walking home from school in the California sun, dreaming about my wedding day, just 10 days away. On 42nd and Clinton, a yellow sedan flagged me down. Charming man asked me for directions. He was on the wrong side of town. With the sweetest boy look, knowing I wouldn't have to carry my books, I jumped in his car, getting closer to home. Take a left at the light, but we went right. In a moment, my joy and affright. Around my neck, he played Russian roulette. With a ribbon from my hair. My body is playground from sunrise to sunset, begging and pleading for the torture to end. I was buried under an abandoned barn. 25 years later, I was almost found. My bones almost ashed to 4 feet down next to the pylon of the apartments built in 1984, still known in the photograph as Jane Doe, number 104, in poem.
Oh, I love this. Oh, I still love this. And I think you brought up something great with Rodney Alcala. He tortured his victims. He absolutely, this was a game to him. And a lot of the times when you're talking about psychopaths and sociopaths, they go ahead and dehumanize people. they take away the value of the particular person. There's stuff in their lives that when they look at people, they don't look at people as people. They look at people as things. They look at people as flesh. They look at people as nothing more than something that satisfies them. There's a justification in their minds that these people are nothing more than something that they get to play with, that they, that it's a toy that they use and a toy that they have. And they justify this by saying, bottom line, that, you know what, because they are this, I can do this because it benefits me, it satisfies me. And that's what they do. Hatter, what do you think of that poem? Unmuted.
I'm sorry, what? You said, talking to me?
Yeah, I was talking to you, sorry. What did you say? Poem?
I like the dead talking to you. I was almost drowned, and I'm still known as Jane Doe. That's a good angle. That sort of gives a helpless feeling to it. It was nicely done.
Excellent. And I am going to change the order just a little bit because we have a person here, Deb. What did you think of Sweet's poem?
Oh, my goodness. I was just reading it while Hatter was talking, and like, around my neck, he played Russian roulette with a ribbon from my hair. My body is his playground from sunrise to sunset, begging and pleading for the torture to end. You want to cry for her. I love how you stepped in, Sweet, from her perspective and made us feel. I mean, like I said, I really want to cry for her. And to that part, where is it? At the end, my bones almost ash, just 4 feet down next to the pylon of the apartment built in 1984 and still known as photograph as Jane Doe number 104. Such a tragic, sad, amazing, right?
Thank you, my dear.
Absolutely. So what we're going to do next is we are going to go to Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy happened to have an IQ of, I believe, let me see, it was 136, okay, which is a near genius. You know, 140 is considered genius level. Ted Bundy actually is the lowest on this group, but I want to put him in here because of his near genius intelligence and his master manipulation, which we will be discussing right after Deb goes ahead and reads this poem for us.
Okay. Okay, this is called Blonde Hair Dye and Short Haircuts and Karate Masters. Here we go. Shining no light off the cavity of darkness, slashing classmates as dark chaos blows, killing neighbors at the college campuses, he laughs, slashing throats as blood flows. Rage brews in veins of the man monster, as his pulse thumps outside the shadows, stalking girls to rape and slice with blades, and brunette female students are the prey. Police officers from the town hunt for him, photographing every chalk outline display, but he mutilates people and then just runs, leaving bloodstains on the death bouquet. Women walk in twos home from schools, calling on the campus cops for their escort. Some of the ladies dyed their tresses blonde. Long-haired gals cut the brown hair short to hamper the targeted view of the monster that stalked them like the killings are a sport. One day, this scumball slashed the eyelids off the young girl that battled, fighting back. Blinded in blood, she kicked him in the groin, grabbed a knife at her neck with a whack, then sliced her palms as she clobbered him, landing that punch that echoed with a crack. The girl then stepped up, striking back again, training in karate for self-defense at the dojo, rising to the top now as an athlete in the field, teaching all in the walls of the training studio. End poem.
Love this. Ted Bundy was an interesting figure. We'll go a little bit more into him. I like this outcome of what he did and everything behind it. there was an inspiration for the women to start protecting themselves during that time because of people like Ted Bundy, people like Edmund Kemper, people who preyed upon the hitchhikers. Hitchhiking was such a common thing back in the 70s. It was pretty much a marketplace for serial killers. It was like a place that they could go and have all of the victims they wanted. And Ted Bundy was one of them that went ahead and took advantage of this situation. To have someone who was actually inspired by this to get better, to turn up into self-defense, I think that's an awesome story of inspiration and an awesome story to take a look into it. I like this. Fight back. Take care of yourselves, and you know what? I think they did an awesome job with that. Great job, Deb. And we'll be going a little bit more into Ted Bundy after we get some comments. Sweet, what do you think of Deb's poem? Sweet, you on mute? Sweepy.
Maybe your dog's racked up.
No problem. Hatter, what do you think?
Yeah, I didn't know Bundy mutilated, like cut the eyelids off. Is that right?
Yeah. I was reading on it, and I was fascinated by that particular, I was going to say victim, but she was definitely a survivor. It blew me away that she started that dojo and worked with so many other women. And an interesting little tidbit, they said that they had never sold as much blonde hair dye as they did during that time period that he was terrorizing.
Oh, that's wild. That's fascinating. Because he ultimately was a person who had this moment that really set him off. He was raised by his maternal grandparents, not as a grandson, but as their actual children. this happened throughout his upbringing until 1969. He was born in 46. So he was 23 years old, and he found a copy of his original birth certificate that showed that his mother was actually not his sister.
So oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
found
right.
out
yeah.
his mother was his sister. They found out that bottom line is the person he thought was his sister was actually his mother, and he was born out of wedlock during that time. That was a stigma. They were trying to avoid that for him, and he never stopped being mad at his mother for never telling who his real father was. And he had to find out himself about the true parentage, and it instantly clicked in him. From a young age, he had a problem with violence and everything like that. His last interview was probably one of the most interesting things I read about him. That interview that I posted online about Ted Bundy, it was actually he requested that popular evangelist Dr. James Dobson have his last interview, which, you know, it's a very interesting thing, because as you listen, as you watch the interview, as you listen to his voice, I don't see him looking at Dr. Dobson that often. He often looked down, looked away, like he was hiding something. You don't know if he was, but it almost looked like he was hiding something during the interview. It's like when I watch that interview, when I hear that interview, I almost think it's like PR trying to fix his image at the end, because he doesn't blame. Once again, he says, you know, it's no one's fault but my own. But then again, he turns around and blames profanity. Not profanity, but pornography. He said at first it was soft, and then he was obsessed with the detective novels that dealt with sexual violence and stuff like that, especially if they were a photo book. This is what he brought forth in that final interview with him, with Dr. James Dobson. But when you take a look at his life, when you listen to his actual confessions, because I've heard some of his confession tapes, it was almost like he didn't want some people hearing some things, and he wanted other people to hear other things, and it was kind of talking out of both sides of his mouth. That I look at that, because he lied about a bunch of things. He claimed that his grandmother was timid and went through electroconvulsive therapy for depression, and that his grandfather was a racist and a xenophobe. But ultimately, other people claim that that is not true, and the mother the grandmother had a stroke due to being overweight and was not mentally ill at all. This was, one of the daughters of the grandparents. You know, there was conflicting stuff that he always used. But I take a look at his life as well, the way he went forward on who he was and everything like that. How do I put this? He ended up getting jobs in the government, especially in Washington State. And I wish I could find this right away, but He ended up getting jobs that were associated with the very opposite thing that he committed. He kidnapped people. He raped them. He got a job with a government agency, and he actually wrote a pamphlet on how to protect yourself from rape. He had turned around and got a job with the state agency that was one of their responsibilities was to search for missing people. He tied himself to these agencies. This was a common thread among these extremely, extremely smart serial killers, because they would, along with him, not only him, but Edmund Kemper, and I'll talk more about him as well. They tied themselves to different. What do I want to say? I got it right here. Edmund Kemper also tied himself with the cops and became friends with the cops. And no one saw these people as these type of people that were serial killers, even though that they were doing this during those times. Bundy worked as an assistant director in Olympia, Washington, of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission. He wrote a pamphlet for women on rape prevention. He later worked for the Department of Emergency Services for the state government, which was involved in the search for missing women. So while he was raping and committing murder on these women, he was working for the agencies that protected women from rape and missing. So, this was part of the intelligence. This was part of the game that he played. And it was absolutely an insane facts when I researched about Ted Bundy. And I found out all about those things on Ted Bundy. It blew me away. It looks like Sweet dropped off the call, so hopefully she'll call back. But Deb, I don't know if you knew any of that stuff about Ted Bundy, but he used his intelligence.
No, as you were sharing the information, I'm sitting here thinking, man, you need a high IQ to keep up with all the different personas that you're trying to portray and all the lies that you're spewing. Otherwise, you get caught a lot sooner. But damn, what's it? Diabolical genius. Deadly.
It really was. It really was. Someone that's able to do all that, to tie themselves into that, they never suspected him. He actually would have gotten away with a lot of this stuff if he didn't turn around and try to fight some of the stuff that he did. If he would have let the law play out, they didn't have enough stuff to try him, but he turned around because he was fighting in this situation. He brought out more stuff. He was too smart for his own good. That was the problem. He thought he was smarter than everybody else, and he thought he was bigger than everyone else. Remember, when you're talking about a psychopath or a sociopath, everyone else is stupid. They think everyone else is at fault. Like, they don't have that type of mental capacity that I have, that I'm going to get away with this stuff because I am smarter than they are. And that's one of the things when you take a look at Ted Bundy, his mindset. He deflected the fault from himself onto this quote-unquote pornography at the end because he did not want to take full responsibility. That is my personal opinion. Whether that's true or not, that's a different story, but definitely something that his story went into. Because you're talking about a person who has 20 confirmed kills and confessed to 30. They suspect he had over 36 victims. They're talking about California, Colorado, Florida, Idaho, Oregon, Utah, Washington. They're talking about him going on a crime spree from 1974 to 1978 and possibly beyond. So this, the thing about it is he brought forth his intelligence thinking that he was smarter than everyone else. And that's a lot of what you look at. As soon as he saw himself as a bastard child, and that's how I'm going to describe him, as a bastard child, because that's the way I think he looked at himself, he turned around and didn't see the value of life. So that's kind of how I think Ted Bundy goes. When you devalue life, boom, right there. Hatter, you want to add anything about Mr. Bundy?
I remember the trials. He represented himself, and at the end, the judge commended him for his intelligence of the law and regretted not being able to him being on the right side of the law that eventually had deemed him to death. Something snaps in that high intelligence. It's just. Let me ask you this: when was these IQ tests taken? Were they already deemed for like? Did he, Ted Bundy, already have it done, or did they do this while they're waiting?
No, usually they did it at one while he was in custody, and the psychiatrists were looking him over. I'm pretty sure. I believe I read where he took two IQ tests, and this was the second one he took. So
yeah.
I want to talk about the next two individuals kind of in unison, and this is Carol Edward Cole, also known as Eddie Cole, and also Edmund Kemper. Edmund Kemper is the only one of these serial killers we're talking about that is still alive today. Edward Cole was executed by lethal injection in 1985. Now, this is the reason I want to bring these two up is because there was a similarity in both of them. And I take a look at this similarity. And I really, really think that people need to understand what their actions and how they treat people affect certain people, especially someone with a high IQ, because a high IQ person justifies everything in thought. So if a person turns around and dehumanizes them, they turn around and dehumanize other people that are similar to those people. Now, Cole was an interesting person because he killed his first murder at the age of 8. It was a retaliation of a boy, and he drowned him in a lake. And everything that pointed to this thought it was an accidental death until he wrote his autobiography. So ultimately, you're taking a look at a person that was that committed his first murder at age 8. Now, what this tells me is that he was susceptible to becoming worse. And what happened was a problem was his mother. And I want to tell you, his mother was married to a person that ended up having to go fight in World War II. The father, while the father was away, the mother had several affairs and often brought him along, put him in another room while she was going and doing something else. She often threatened him with violence, said she would beat him if he told his father. She embarrassed him by dressing him in girls' clothes, and because his name was Carol, he would often be ridiculed at school because of his first name. And ultimately, when you take a look at a woman, a mother who treats their child in this particular way, you're looking at a person who turns into a powder keg. And they view women not as human beings, not as people, but as that figure that turns around and humiliates people. So they are considered, you consider me less than a human, I'm going to look at everybody who looks like you as less than a human. And ultimately, that's what I see within Carol Cole, him justifying his murders through that particular thing. He did petty crimes young. He was discharged from the army for stealing pistols. He attacked people, and almost instantly, after he attacked people, he got himself into a mental hospital. And guess what he was diagnosed with? He was, once again, we have another person that was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. The same thing as what Rodney Alcala was diagnosed with. Let me, for people who don't know what antisocial personality disorder, let me tell you what it is. It's a personality disorder characterized by limited capacity for empathy and a long-term pattern of disregard or violations of the rights of others. So ultimately, you look at someone as less. You don't care about their what they think, how they feel, who they are. You don't even look at them as a human being. You care about your desires, what turns around and sets you off as a person. And this is Carol Cole. This is who he became after he was treated in a certain way. I'm not going to blame and anything else for that. Except, you know what, he was unable. This is the ultimate definition of a sociopath, a person who does wrong but doesn't recognize they do wrong. When he was asked in his interview, this was his death row interview. This was the interview the day before he got the lethal injection. He goes, they go, Ed, do you think you deserve to, you know, do you think you deserve to die with everything you did? And he goes, his answer wasn't that he didn't think he deserved to die. He just said, I don't want to die. That's it. That's all he said. I don't want to die. And thing about it is also there were a bunch of people that were trying to get his death sentence commuted, but he said he told them not to do it. He said, forget about it. You know, the ACLU, the United Methodist Church of Reno, a bunch of his other ones. But he said, no, let them kill me. It doesn't matter. He absolutely checked out. He checked out. And the whole thing about it, though, is, you know, he turns around and he doesn't see the blame on himself once again. This is sociopathic. This is, yeah, this is big-time sociopathic. Let me see. We don't have a poem on Carol Cole, but I am going to read another poem from one of our poets here. What do you think about? I'm gonna let you make a comment on Carol Cole and what I told you. Patter.
Oh, yeah. I seem to vaguely remember the plan on trying to get his death sentence revoked, and him saying don't want you to or whatever he had put it. But yeah, you got to ask yourself, what, just because you were bullied as a kid, whether your name or how you look, or, I mean, that happens to kids all the time, but when you're in that club, almost 200 club, your social, something misfires in your head at some point, and then you're just in denial, or just you justify all your actions.
When asked why he committed his murders, he said, "I found these women to be adulterous. They reminded me of my mother." It's like they're surrogates for someone else. And that's why I suggest that when people take a look at certain people that they have authority over, be very careful how you speak. You don't know what you are creating. You don't know what you're molding. I don't even know if it was created. I don't know if he could have stopped the Carol Cole. I don't know if he could have ever been stopped. I don't know if he would have ended up doing the same thing he was doing if his mother didn't treat him the way she did.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, you gotta ask yourself. You gotta ask yourself that. Well, yeah.
Yeah, you really do. And that's where one of these problems come in. And you'll see on the next person I talk about, which is Edmund Kemper, a very similar thing. I just want to say, Carol Cole, and I'm going to put this out here. Where is he? Da, 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 da. His IQ is 152. So he was in the genius level. He was right around where Einstein was. So it's amazing where, you know, like I said, once the human value is dehumanized, once there becomes no more value on humanity, it's a justifiable thing in their minds. It's a crazy thought, but it is. And what I'm going to do right now is read a poem from one of our poets by the name of Wayne T.W. Francis. And this is called Bloody Geniuses. I actually like this poem. So here we go. Bloody Geniuses. Some say geniuses turned mad. I'd say we all have a bit of it in us. But their actions ended in blood. Sadly, it was not from sharp floss. Maybe they were just bored. But the mischief was not little. It ended in trails of blood and with many people cross. Began when they were floored and rained upon spittle, lost compassion for all men, and liked them better dead. and poem. Now, he puts in the author's note that the word men there, and I did take this with that, was a traditional sense denoting the entire human race. And this is what I'm talking about. When they end up dehumanizing people, dehumanizing women, they lose all compassion. Their empathy gets taken out and gets destroyed. And this poem right here actually points to that type of scenario. They lost compassion for all men. They lost compassion for all humankind, for all women, for life. They dehumanized people. And, yeah, ultimately their desires, their rages, their whatevers that pushed them towards this did not allow them to have a guilty thought at the time. And out of all the interviews that I've ever seen out of all of these people, there was only one person that showed compassion, and we will be talking about him next. Hatter, what did you think about that poem?
Yeah, that's pretty descriptive how the mind snaps. The first victim has got to be a cornerstone for what comes after. I mean, usually it gets worse. Your actions get worse as the murders go on. Lost compassion for all men. You know, I got to say it. There was a reason for the church, and I'm not talking any specific church, through time. Times changed. The church changed. Either the fear of God, they put in you in the Wild West, or a little more romanticism in Europe in the early ages. But there was a reason for it, and that was to have you grow up with a little spirituality, for lack of a better word, on what life is, with compassion towards other people. And when you don't have it, and a child grows up without it, that void fills with this darker, thoughts or justification of how to get even or how to make it things right, striking out and killing people. I mean, my God.
Now, I love that.
Very,
I love
very
that.
Well written.
I love the point that you made about the first killing, and then it becomes easier after that, because that is similar to what Jeffrey Dahmer shared. That it was, and it's also similar to what Edmund Kemper shared, because they both, when they talk about it, they talk about a situation where you put the stuff in your car and you just ride around with like the tape, with the rope, with whatever that you're going to use to bind these people and to kill them and do whatever with them. And you drive around with it at first, and it's a fantasy, and you don't know if you're going to go through with this. It's like Kemper said, let's talk about Edmund Kemper, because this guy is very interesting. Like I said, he's the only of these serial killers that is still alive. He is serving life in jail, and he's got 8 concurrent sentences in the state of California. So he is there. He is actually imprisoned at the California Medical Facility. So he is definitely, when you take a look at him, he has very similar traits psychiatrically than the other ones have done. They take a look at it. I see straight up that he exhibited antisocial behavior. So
So very common trend for all of these particular individuals, these extremely intelligent ones. Now, what's similar to Carol Cole is that this person's mother absolutely decimated him. Let me say, this is what his father said about his mother. And this is what you got to understand. She absolutely destroyed Edmund. Edmund was the third Edmund, Edmund the third. His father was Edmund Jr. He said this about his ex-wife: suicide missions in wartime and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her. And he added, more than 396 days and nights fighting on the front were not as bad as living with her.
Wow.
Yes, this is how bad this woman was. She would yell at him. She would humiliate him. She did everything in her power to just decimate these people, her husband and her son. And it was a sad, sad state of affairs. But just like the other one, it was the same one. Edmund was 13 pounds when he was born. He ended up at 6'9". He's 6'9", nearly 300 pounds. He's a big boy. Yes. And she absolutely was super cruel to him in everything she did. He, because of all of this absolute abuse that he took from her, he became fixated on cruelty to animals. He buried a pet cat alive, dug it up, decapitated it, and mounted the head on a spike. He lied to his family, and he said, I got pleasure from lying to the family about that cat. And there was so much more that he did. When another family cat, when it was showing more affection to his sister than him, he ended up killing the cat as well. You know, and ultimately, through all this abuse and through everything that he ended up, just having these awful dark fantasies, and it continued to mess with him and mess with his mind. He ended up taking his sister's dolls and having these dark rituals. He asked his sister to play a game where he would called electric chair and gas chamber, where he told his younger sister to flip a switch and then he pretend to writhe in pain like he was in an electric chair or in a gas chamber. His older sister was super mean to him as well. I think she learned from the mother. She tried to push him in front of a train one time. She pushed him in the deep end of a swimming pool when he couldn't swim and nearly killed him there. And the only real relationship he had was with his father. And the problem is they ended up getting a divorce, and he was sent to live with his mother. And this absolutely destroyed him. This absolutely. At the age of 15, he was 6'4". And his mother called him a weirdo and everything like that. She goes, she said to he heard her talking to his father, and she said, I don't want to give him affection. I think I'll turn him gay. And stuff like that, that just absolutely destroyed him. He actually called her a sick, angry woman. And it's thought that she had a personality disorder as well. When he was 14, he ran away to his father. But ultimately, his father went and sent him to live. His father was remarried and had a stepson. So he couldn't keep Edmund there. So he ended up sending him to live with his grandparents. And this was the first time. At the age of 15, he pretty much was very upset that he ended up with his grandparents, because it was like him being kind of thrown out and disregarded by both his mother and his father now. He saw this as that, because he said his grandfather pretty much was senile and his grandmother emasculated both of them, you know, and it was, he did not like it. So one time he ended up having this super argument with his grandmother. He got upset, grabbed a rifle his grandfather gave him for hunting, came back in and fatally shot her at the age of 15. This was his first killing. And what happened was, as soon as his grandfather came in, he went outside in the driveway and shot him dead as well. And when asked why he did this, he said that he just wanted to see what it felt like to kill his grandma, and he didn't want his grandfather to see his wife dead, so he killed him before he came in the house. That was his reason for killing them. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, but the doctors at the youth jail that he went to said no, he did not have any of these. There was no flight of ideas, no interference, no expression of delusions or hallucinations. So they said no, he doesn't have any of this. And was re-diagnosed with personality trait disturbance and a passive aggressive. He was given two IQ tests. First one was 136. The second one was 145. What was interesting is all the psychiatrists at this hospital he was sent to said he was a model prisoner. He was trained to administer psychiatric tests to other prisoners. They looked at him as a good worker and not the typical sociopath. He took pride in his work, which was not a tendency of a sociopath. He became a member of the JCs. They said he developed some new tests himself, specifically a overt hostility scale. What is interesting is Kemper later said that he understood how psychiatric tests worked, and he was able to manipulate the psychiatrists themselves by understanding this test. That's how he used his intelligence to get out of that situation, get released from that situation. He actually said he learned a lot from the tests he gave to sex offenders. So ultimately, you're talking, that's what he had. And ultimately, he was released, and they expunged his juvenile record from one of the psychiatrists. And
what year was this?
This was back in 1969 is when he was released on parole. 72 is when his juvenile records were expunged. Now, here's what makes him like Ted Bundy. And I mentioned earlier when we were talking about Ted Bundy, about how Ted Bundy tied himself to government agencies and everything like this. So Edmund Kemper tied himself with, he took a community college. He wanted to become a police, but since he was 6'9", he couldn't join the police force. They said there was a height requirement. You had to be shorter than a certain thing. But he ended up going in and maintaining a relationship with the Santa Cruz police at a particular bar called the Jury Room. He described himself as a friendly nuisance, but he did this on purpose to try to understand how close the police were to catching this serial killer that would give people that would he ultimately was another hitchhike person. He would pick up people hitchhiking and end up killing the women. But he said in an interview that he actually gave about 100 rides before he finally turned around and killed his first person. But he had that fantasy, and he kept all the equipment for that fantasy in the trunk of his car. And the cops could have easily brought him in and found out about him prior. They almost found the pistol he used to shoot people. They almost found it, but he instead gave them a gun that was in his trunk instead of a gun that was under his driver's seat. And they, you know, and since he was a friend of theirs and everything like that, they never questioned him. You know, he used a lot of things. They asked him, so why, how were you able to get away with all of this? He said, watching television, learning the behaviors of the cops, doing all of this. And as you'll find out from Jeffrey Dahmer, how he was similar to Dahmer, he said that he had this desire to kill. He was addicted to the killing. And ultimately, it was found out, and he actually said that all these women were a surrogate for his mother. And ultimately, I think, because the second to last person he ended up killing was his mother. And he absolutely cut her head off, put her head on a dresser, and yelled at it for an hour.
Jesus.
It's crazy. So, and then he killed her best friend just to add insult to injury. He said, I was planning to kill, you know, go all over the country and kill more people, but ultimately all the motivation was gone, and he turned himself in.
Wow. I was wondering if these guys talked.
There's a lot of them that did stuff to the bodies, and I'm not going into the details on everything like that, but, you know, it was, these people were messed up. It was the dehumanization factor. And I really think that they justified more of their own desires than the value of those people's lives. And that's how I really look at this as well. And where do we finish? Let's, first of all, I'm going to read my poem. Then we're going to go into the final person here, and that's Jeffrey Dahmer. And then we will play a SoundCloud from Titus. So let me read my poem first. It's called The Genius. It's called Genius of the Killers. And it goes like this. Checkmate in the game of backgammon, swirling of the opaque hands of Hulshan, whispers and the dialogue crack in the eggshell brain. I swam in the skulls of genius. Killers mark the rubbish breath. The escargot meat sacks filling veins with opal adrenaline. Fiddlesticks crack in bundled stacks, formaldehyde chipmunks, fur and bones and pickle jars stash in an Ohio hut. Science on windowsill skulls, on makeshift crosses, hernia scars on the stomach frilled with the childhood losses. Mother showered lovers in flesh. Son was shrouded as a girl. Abuse while daddy made off to work. Nightmares from the blackish lips. Dwayne in the lake at 8. Stockton confessions. Deadlight obsessions. Institution confessions. Model photographs with the twisting of televisions. He is skydiving or water skiing. Creep, creep, no date. Final humiliation to berate her severed head. Sans the motivation walk, sipping the drink of the dead. Sparky for the bastard. Dormitory dinners for the cripple. Rivers ripple with kerplunk. Necks crushed. Bodies dug. Psychiatrist to the serials. End poem.
Wow. Now, I wish I had it in front of me. I didn't see it. Did you post it? I didn't see it.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I posted it.
Oh, I didn't refresh. Okay. Let me try it again. shoot. There's a part that I was trying to remember.
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't post it. You're right. I didn't. Sorry.
Okay.
I thought I did. Let me go ahead and post that. But, yeah, I tried to kind of capture a little bit of every single one of these killers in there. And like I said, you'll recognize Jeffrey Dahmer here in a second. But it's on the board now.
Yeah, I see it. I'm looking at it. I was going to say, when do you consider mom at fault on the one, you know, this last guy?
When do I consider mother's fault?
Yeah, I mean, apparently, I'm sure that there was an only child, right? So he had nothing but time to sit and ponder the hate that he was feeling thrown at him.
I don't think he was an only child. I think sisters?
Okay.
Yeah, he had some sisters.
Oh, okay.
His older sister was extremely bad to him as well. So not to the point of the mother, but she did try to push him in front of a train.
Yeah.
I guess that is pretty bad.
That's something you would remember for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, you know, the women define themselves by the way that they react and treat him. And that's how he ends up seeing them.
I know what I was going to say. You mentioned the TV. I remember, I think it was in the 90s, when all this CSI shows started, that when people were asked, why did you do it? I thought I could get away with it because I watched this show. And there was a couple of them that came close to creating the perfect crime. So on these shows now, they don't describe it entirely to get away with it anymore. I've been told. I mean, I read this or I heard this. I'm not quite sure it's true.
Edmund Kemper was back in the 70s when this happened, And he was saying that he figured this out from the crime shows, a lot of them that he studied, and he saw how people got away with stuff and what the cops look for and everything like that. So, yeah,
right.
You are right that they take away some of the stuff away from this just so people don't really use everything against them. So, yeah, you're right on that. And this brings us in to Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer, very similarly to Edmund Kemper, talked about a desire inside themselves to commit these murders, the fantasy. Now, what I noticed about Dahmer, once again, is he had this strange relationship with his mother, not to the point of these last two, but let me see, where was it? His parents argued a lot. His father was an actual, he was a chemist. He actually was into science, hugely into science. And his mother was a teletype instructor. So, you ultimately think, you look at them, and it's the nice family. But the mother also, I believe this was the one where she was a hypochondriac, and she needed super attention to herself, and she was always looking for attention to herself. And it kind of, when toddler Jeffrey Dahmer was growing up, mom would want more of the attention than he did. She was jealous of the attention that he got and tried to pull attention away from him. She was a hypochondriac. She suffered from depression. Like I said, she pulled all of the attention away from the kid and put it on her. Now, this put his attention to other places. He remembers he was happy and energetic until he had a double hernia surgery right before his fourth birthday, and something clicked in his head. One thing is that, the father was often at the science department doing his chemistry stuff, and the mother, she was always, in that state of woe is me, woe is me, woe is me. So ultimately, he showed early signs of abandonment for that. And mother became pregnant with a second child. The baby's name, it ended up being his brother. Okay. I'm not sure. I don't read much into that, but what ended up happening is, his father found some animal bones beneath the family home. And instantly, because Dahmer didn't really have an association with his parents, he became fixated with these animal bones. He called them his fiddlesticks. And that's where I get the word fiddlesticks from. And I'm starting to use that more. I think that's it's an actual poetic way to say bones. It's something that, struck to me, and he ended up becoming more and more interested in the anatomy of animals, where their bones were located. He became fixated with this. It just put into him who he was. More and more, he became collecting insects, and skeletons, and He put some of them in jars of formaldehyde. He stowed them in a hut when they were living in Ohio. That's part of my poem. What happened is when they were having a chicken dinner one time, he asked his father, remember, he was a chemist, what would happen if we put chicken bones in bleach? And the father thought, man, my son is becoming scientific. Let me show him what happens. And he showed him how to safely bleach and preserve animal bones. And this was part of the technique that he picked up as a serial killer in preserving human bones. He would dissect and bury these animals. He would take roadkill, dissect, put the animals and bury them right beside the hut. And occasionally he'd put skulls and put them on makeshift crosses. This was all what he did before, you know.
That's a common trait, characteristic of a lot of arsonists and killers is abuse of animals as a kid. When that's noticed, you seek help. It's something that's serious.
Yep, and it wasn't really. He didn't have much of a use to it. He always took what was already dead. But during when I was listening to one of his interviews, he was, you know, he said that he figured out he was gay when he reached puberty. You know, that's something you don't tell your parents during that age or during there. He did not want to tell his parents because there was a stigma during that time.
Sure.
Back in the 70s, yeah. Stigma on being gay back in the 70s. So he wasn't. But he had all of these fantasies. And he just fantasizing about them. And what he ultimately fantasized was about him taking total control of people, taking total control of the situation. So he often, once again, this was another thing where he put stuff in the back of his car, drove around, never really acted on them, but always had the fantasy of what would happen. You know, ultimately, you take a look around. He, in 78, was his first murder, okay? He, 3 weeks after his graduation, he picked up a hitchhiker. That was one of his things. He always had that fantasy about picking up a hitchhiker and totally having them, totally having control over them. He went to their house, had a few beers, and he ended up, waking up. He didn't know he killed the person. He didn't realize it, but he ended up killing him. No, this was the second one that he had about. This one he brought back to his house. He still lived with his parents at the time. His parents were away. And he ended up just beating him to death and strangling him. And then he explored him. He had total control because he took his life. And this is what he ended up dissecting the body and burying it in the basement. And after that, the killing stopped. He stopped killing. This was back in 78. So after 78,
how many had he killed up to that point? How many victims did he have?
None. This was his first victim.
Gotcha.
He had none, and he stopped killing. He wasn't sure. He's not been sure why he did, but he did join the army at that time, and we're seeing that there is a little bit of, commonality about.
We're talking Dahmer, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
He went to college and joined the army. Went to basic training at Fort McClellan. I've been there. And became a medical specialist at Sam Houston. Been there as well. He bottom line was insubordinate. He got beaten pretty bad at Fort Sam. He ended up getting deployed to Germany. He was average or slightly average above that. He was deemed unsuitable for Army service and was later discharged. He did receive an honorable discharge, though. And he wasn't seen as going to be having any problems. He was sent to Fort Jackson, and he'd given a plane ticket anywhere in the country that he wanted to go. And he went to Miami Beach. So that was the end of his military career. He returned to Ohio and got drunk driving charge, drunk and disorderly, and ended up back in Wisconsin. And
how tall was he? Wasn't he a tall guy?
Tall and skinny, really skinny. He was 6'1". That's what he was. But he was really skinny. And like I said, he went and he drugged people is what he did. He drugged his victims. But ultimately, his second murder was
kids.
The one.
They were all kids.
Not all. Young men, kids. He went to the gay bars often.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah. Ultimately, he found a 25-year-old man, brought him to a hotel, wasn't planning to do anything to him except have a good time and everything like that. He drugged him, laid behind him, and when he woke up from the next day, the guy's chest was caved in, and it was black and blue, and he was dead. And Dahmer said he had no memory at all of killing him. And there was a psychiatrist I saw on TV that said this was a common thing with a person who had thoughts like him. He would just totally blank out, which was understandable in his situation. But ultimately, when you listen to Dahmer, you listen to a person who doesn't say that he committed any of this. You listen to a person who says, I have this urge, I have this desire, I didn't want to do this, but this is what I had. Ultimately, there is another just pure sociopath. That is what he falls into, is a category of sociopath, because they still don't take the full responsibility in saying, hey, I did something wrong. No, I did something because of the urges I had. And that's a lot of what these people do. They have these urges. They have these desires. They take these victims and they dehumanize them. There's a common thread in each one of these people. Their mindset, their sociopathic mindset, says that since these people really aren't human beings, I can justify taking their lives to fulfill my needs. That is a common thread among all five of these monsters. because they don't, there is no line between right and wrong, between good and evil. There is only a line between humanity and objectivity. And they see these people more as objects than as people. There is no value behind their lives, so they can take their lives.
Do you think that's a justification after the fact, or is that they go in with that?
I think that's the mindset of a genius. I think that's a mindset of a genius, because when you take a look at a genius, especially a sociopathic genius, you're looking at someone who justifies actions. They look for a justification of actions. So this is more than just after the fact. This is during, and this is everything. And this is a sociopathic genius, which is a different level of sociopath.
So out of all these guys, which one do you think was more sinister?
I'm going to go with Rodney Alcala. I'm going to go with our very first one, the dating game murderer. I think he probably, out of anyone, he tried to make himself look like a crazy person at the end, but he was more of the psychopath than the sociopath. This was all a game.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was
even
probably
Bundy,
the most...
Huh?
Rodney Alcala. He was probably the most deviant person out of the whole thing. Where the other ones, I think, fall under the sociopathic thing. It's often said the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath. The sociopath doesn't see the line between good and evil, and they perform evil, where the psychopath knows what good and evil is, and they perform evil anyways.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So we're almost to the end of the show here, so I'm going to go ahead and just give us a little treat of Titus giving us a little recording on Jack the Ripper, and then we'll call it a night after this. But let's go ahead and listen to a little Titus.
What you having, Jack? A Bloody Mary? Mahogany, my dear, such fear as misread you choose to martyr juice, rather be ginger. A hint of paprika would darn well injure your ego. Merlot, with a bit more bloodshed, Worcester sauce gives it that chestnut colour. I see your sweet talking me around with lilac, replacing the vodka with May's best. Hijack a vanilla pod pimento makes the cheeks fuller. It is just as well it is not Mary Queen of Scots. Chrome demands severance. It'll guilt trip her thinking cayenne pepper. We old Jack the Ripper, the whore with whom he'd rather call the shots.
Oh, I love this. You know that? I love this because he's ultimately mixing in Jack the Ripper, but he's also talking about the cocktail Jack the Ripper. This is a clever little one. What you having, Jack? Bloody Mary. I love him putting his accent in there and everything like that. He almost pulled a little Cockney out of there, which is I think is just brilliant. If you've ever listened to a Cockney accent,
if you've ever watched Oliver, the Fagin.
Mm-hmm. It's your Cockney accent, Governor.
Yeah.
So I always love what Titus puts out there, and this one is just brilliant. And a great way to end our show here. I just want to once again put all thanks out there. Thanks, Sweet Deb. Appreciate you showing up, Hatter. It was a pleasure to have you on the show again. Everybody who's listening in around wherever you're at, I know I got a good friend from Cali who's listening in, and thank you from my gaming buddies, whoever is there. Always enjoy having them listen in because they always have fun.
So what are we going to have next time?
Next time. I think we're gonna do some more confessions. We're gonna do some confessions. I'm thinking of how about we do the Night Stalker, Robert Ramirez,
or Child Killers, Robert Ramirez. Yeah, we had the dude out here, the Vampire Slayer was, in fact, it happened. His killings happened one street over from where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah, in, Richard Ramirez. That's who it was. That's the Night Stalker. Richard. But he's got interview out there. Maybe I'm going to at least stick once a month with some type of serial killer interviews because I think that it's a fascinating to hear their own, what they have to say. But stay tuned for
I'll play the killer.
Yeah.
I'll play the killer. You interview me.
Well, stay tuned. I will announce later what we're going to be doing. I haven't really thought about it. I was so excited about this show because I knew I was going to have fun with it. Because this was an absolute super interesting. I've got some other people that I'm looking at. One of them happens to be Anthony Sowell. Another one is Herb Baumeister. I'm also thinking about doing a show on Camp Keller, which is an absolute crazy, crazy story as well.
I got
you.
Want to
add a little something, Hatter?
Yeah, you can have an interview with a woke serial killer.
That would be great. All right. I wanted to once again thank everybody. We only got a couple minutes left on air here. So
all right.
Thank you all for showing up, and we really appreciate it. And like I said, I have fun with this subject. So this is something we learn from. And I'll give a little something. I'm not bragging, but my IQ is 147. So I looked at this through a very high IQ as well, trying to figure it out and solve it.
I've had to take it three times. You know, it went in intervals 137, 139, then 141. So it got better each time I took it.
Yeah, exactly. And that falls under the genius as well. So you're able to, like I said, when you talk about that type of IQ, you talk about looking at things in a different way.
Seeking knowledge in any way. Yeah.
Yep.
Things
analytics
can drive you crazy. Okay, man.
Yeah.
Good show.
Thank you for calling, and good night, everybody.
Yep. I'll talk to you later.
Yep.
Bye.